Part 9. The Heart in Conflict.
Old-timers and true fans still cherish their memories of Bat Durston, that fearless scourge of the spaceways whose adventures appeared so often in Galaxy in the early 50s. Bat always got the cover in those days, the back cover. Under the legend, "You'll Never See It in Galaxy," ran twin columns. Hoofs drumming, Bat Durston came galloping down through the narrow pass at Eagle Gulch, a tiny gold colony 400 miles north of Tombstone. He spurred hard for a low overhang of rimrock, and at that point a tall, lean wrangler stepped out from behind a high boulder, six-shooter in a suntanned hand. "Rear back and dismount, Bat Durston," the stranger lipped thinly. "You don't know it, but this is your last saddle jaunt through these here parts." Jets blasting, Bat Durston came screeching down through the atmosphere of Bliznaj, a tiny planet 7 billion light-years from Sol. He cut out his super hyperdrive for the landing, and at that point a tall, lean spaceman stepped out of the tail assembly, proton gun blaster in a space-tanned hand. "Get back from those controls, Bat Durston," the tall stranger lipped thinly. "You don't know it, but this is your last space trip through this particular section of the universe." "Sound alike?" Editor H.L. Gold would write beneath the twin columns. "They should. One is merely a Western transplanted to some alien and impossible planet. If this is your idea of science fiction, you're welcome to it. You'll never find it in Galaxy. What you will find in Galaxy is the finest science fiction, authentic, plausible, thoughtful, written by authors who do not automatically switch over from crime waves to Earth invasions, by people who know and love science fiction for people who also know and love it." The ad appeared on the premier issue of Galaxy in September 1950 and turned up again on many subsequent issues. That was back when I was a wee lad of two. I have pictures to prove it. Even Rocky Jones was in my future at that point. Rocky and Bat had surely palled around in Space Ranger school, along with Heinlein, Howard, Tolkien, Lovecraft, and the Fantastic Four. By the time I reached a point where I was writing SF myself, Galaxy was well past its H.L. Golden Age. Gold gave up the reins, the helm, the starship controls, in 1961 after an auto accident, and Frederick Pohl stepped in for a distinguished stint as editor. Toward the end of the decade, Eiler Jacobson succeeded Pohl and hired Gardner Dozois to read his slush. The rest is history, as you know if you've read my earlier commentaries. I never sold another story to Galaxy while Jacobson was editor, though I did come close once or twice. I did sell many more stories to Ted White, though after the exit to Sanbretta, most of my stuff appeared in Amazing, not Fantastic. But the market where I made my reputation, where all my early award nominees appeared, and ultimately my first Hugo winner, was Analog, the leading magazine in the field, which for decades had come to epitomize hard science fiction under its legendary editor, John W. Campbell, Jr. JWC passed away just as I was breaking in, and Ben Bova succeeded him at Analog. Campbell is rightly regarded as a great editor. He remade the field when he took over Astounding in the 30s and gave science fiction its golden age. He was famous for developing new writers as well. But somehow I doubt that he would have responded as favorably as Bova did to the melancholy, romantic, downbeat stories I was writing in the early 70s. Had Campbell lived for another 10 years, my career would have taken a much different path, I suspect, along with many other careers. Bova came to the editor's chair as a science fiction writer of impeccable credentials. Ben was known for hard SF, real SF, and that was important in those vanished days of yesteryear when the war between the old wave and the new wave still raged. Nonetheless, the moment he was enthroned, Ben began to open up the magazine, and stories soon appeared within the hollowed pages of Analog that would never have appeared under JWC, mine own among them. This was not an entirely painless process, as any glance at the letter column of that period would tell you. Every new issue contained one or two cancel-my-subscription letters from old subscribers outraged at the appearance of a profane word, a sex scene, or a less-than-competent man. Fortunately, they were a minority. The Reborn Analog became the best short fiction market of the 70s, and Ben Bova won the Hugo for Best Editor 5 years in a row, from 1973 to 1977, and once again in 1979. The first sale I made to Bova, my third sale overall, and the first one that wasn't lost before being bought, was actually a science fact article about computer chess. I had been captain of my college chess team at Northwestern, where some friends of mine had written a chess-playing program for the big campus mainframe, a giant CDC 6400 that lived in its own sealed, temperature-controlled building. When Chess 4.0 defeated rival programs from a half-dozen other colleges to win the world's first computer chess championship, I knew I had an article, and indeed I did. It was the only science fact article I ever sold to Analog, the only one I ever wrote. I was a journalist, not a scientist. But once I'd sold a science fact article to Analog, no one could question my bona fides, the way they were then questioning all those squishy soft New Wave writers who were selling to Orbit and New Dimensions. Though Bova had broadened Analog's horizons, the magazine still had a reputation of being hard-nosed, steel-clad, scientifically rigorous, and perhaps a bit puritanical. Gordon Dozois once told a woman I was chasing that there was no point in going to bed with me, since when you sold to Analog, a white van pulled up in front of your house, and two guys in silver jumpsuits confiscated your penis. I will not comment on the truth of this, except to note that Gardner himself later sold to Analog. The Computer Was a Fish, my science fact article about David Slate and his champion chess-playing program, was shortly followed by With Morning Comes Mistfall and The Second Kind of Loneliness and A Song for Laia and all the rest. I had other markets besides Analog, of course. Ted White bought as many stories from me as did Bova. Amazing and Fantastic under White were terrific magazines. I also sold to the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction and managed to hit many of the original anthology series of the day. But I got my share of rejections as well. No writer likes being rejected, though it comes with the territory, and you need to get used to it. A few of mine were especially galling, though. Those were the ones where the editors had no problems with my plot or characterization or style, and even went out of their way to say that they'd enjoyed reading the stories. They rejected them nonetheless, because they weren't real science fiction. Night Shift was about the night shift at a busy spaceport, as the spaceships come and go. They could just as easily have been trucks, an editor said. Another said that With Morning Comes Mistfall put him in mind of attempts to find a Loch Ness monster. Even Second Kind of Loneliness took its lumps. This could be a story about a lighthouse keeper, one rejection said. The focus is not on the star ring or the null space vortex so much as the rather pathetic protagonist with his hopes and dreams and fears. I mean, really, what were these guys trying to tell me? I was an Analog writer. I'd sold a science fact article. And they were claiming I wrote Bat Durston stories. Of course, it was true that I based Night Shift on my father's experience as a longshoreman and a few weeks I once spent working in a truck dispatch office. And it was true that the seed for With Morning Comes Mistfall had been planted when I read an article in the paper about a scientist who was taking a fleet of sonar-equipped boats to Loch Ness, intending to flush out Nessie or disprove him. And it was true that Second Kind of Loneliness was peopled by my own personal demons, based on incidents and characters from my own life, as was A Song for Laia. And even Sand Kings, a few years later, started with that guy I knew in college and his aquarium of piranha. But so what? When I wrote the stories, I moved them to other planets, put aliens in them and spaceships. How much more bloody science fictional could they get? All those years when I'd been growing up and reading fantasy and horror and science fiction, I'd never once worried about which was what and what was which, or where the boundaries were drawn, or whether this was real science fiction and real fantasy and real horror. My staple fare in the 50s was made up of paperbacks and comic books. I knew the SF magazines were out there somewhere, but seldom saw one, so I remained blissfully unaware of Bat Durston and Horace Gold's fulminations against him. As a kid, I did not even know the proper names for all the genres and subgenres. To me, they were monster stories and space stuff and sword and sorcery. Or weird stuff. That was my father's term for all of it. He liked westerns, you see, but his son liked weird stuff. But now that I was a published professional writer, and an analog writer at that, with penis, thank you very much, it behooved me to find out what real science fiction was. So I reread Damon Knight's In Search of Wonder, James Blish's The Issue at Hand, and L. Sprague de Camp's Science Fiction Handbook, and looked into Locus and Science Fiction Review. I paid careful attention to Alexei Panshin's SF in Dimension columns and Amazing. I followed the debate between the old wave and new wave with interest, since that new wave crap wasn't real science fiction either, according to the old wave guys. And of course, I paid careful attention to the various definitions of science fiction. There were a lot of those about, many of them mutually contradictory. L. Sprague de Camp defined SF in a Science Fiction Handbook, and Kingsley Amis defined it differently in New Maps of Hell. Ted Sturgeon had a definition, Fred Pohl had a definition, Reginald Bretner had a definition, David G. Hartwell had a definition, Alexei Panshin had a definition, and over in a corner stood Damon Knight pointing at something. The old wave and the new wave each championed its own view of what the genre ought to be. H.L. Gold must surely have had a definition, since he knew Bat Dursten did not fit it. I absorbed all of this as best I could, and finally discerned the shape of a real science fiction story, as opposed to the stuff that I was writing. The ultimate template for the true science fiction story was Isaac Asimov's first sale, Marooned Off Vesta, published in Amazing in 1939. Asimov would later write more famous stories and better stories. Well, to tell the truth, pretty much everything he wrote after that was a better story. But Marooned Off Vesta was sure enough pure quill science fiction, in which everything hinges on the fact that water boils at a lower temperature in vacuum. This was a sobering realization for me. For although I had pages of scribbled notes for the stories I wanted to tell next year and the year after and the year after that, not one of them had anything to do with the boiling point of water. If truth be told, it seemed to me that Asimov had said just about all there was to say on that particular subject, leaving nothing for the rest of us except, well, Bat Dursten. The thing is, though, the more I considered old Bat and Asimov and Heinlein and Campbell and Wells and Verne and Vance and Anderson and Le Guin and Brackett and Williamson and De Camp and Kuttner and Moore and Cordwainer Smith and Doc Smith and George O. Smith and Northwest Smith and all the rest of the Smiths and the Joneses, too, the more I realized something that H.L. Gould did not. Boys and girls, they're all Bat Dursten stories. All of mine and all of yours and all of his and all of hers. The Space Merchants, which Gold serialized in Galaxy as Gravy Planet, is about Madison Avenue in the 50s. The Forever War is about Vietnam. Neuromancer is a caper novel tricked up in fancy prose. And Asimov's Galactic Empire bears a suspicious likeness to one the Romans had a while back. Why else would Bel Rios remind us so much of this guy, Belisarius? And when you look really, really hard at Marooned Off Vesta, it turns out that it's not about the boiling point of water after all. It's about some desperate men trying to survive. Step back and squint hard at the back cover of that first issue of Galaxy, if you will, and you will realize how easily those two columns might have been reversed. The same advertisement could just as well have been run on a Western magazine with only minor changes. "You'll never see it in six-gun stories," the editor might well have trumpeted. "Sound alike? They should. One is merely a sci-fi story transplanted to the range. If this is your idea of Western fiction, you're welcome to it. You'll never find it in six-gun stories. What you will find here is the finest Western fiction, authentic, plausible, thoughtful, written by people who know and love the Old West, for people who also know and love it. So I will see your Bat Dursten, Mr. Gold, and I'll raise you William Faulkner, Casablanca, and The Bard." In the film The Goodbye Girl, Richard Dreyfuss plays an actor forced to portray Richard III as a lisping, effeminate poof by a genius director. These days, that no longer seems quite so much like a parody as it once did. The London stage has given us Derek Jarman's notorious modern dress version of Marlowe's Edward II, wherein Piers Gaveston's chief item of wardrobe is a studded leather jockstrap. When I was last in the West End, they were presenting a Coriolanus set against the terror of revolutionary France. The most recent film version of Romeo and Juliet made it a tale of warring urban street gangs, complete with automobiles, helicopters, and television reporters. And if you have not seen Ian McClellan's film of Richard III, set in a fascist England during the 1930s, you've missed some fabulous art direction and cinematography and a mesmerizing performance by McClellan, whose portrayal of Dickie Crookback is equal to Olivier's. One might argue that Richard III is rightfully about the Wars of the Roses, not the fascist movements of the 30s. One might also insist that Coriolanus should be set in Rome, not Paris. One might point out rather forcefully that Mercutio was not, in fact, a black drag queen. All that is true, as far as it goes. And yet, sometimes, more often than not, the Bard's plays still work, no matter how bizarrely the genius directors decide to trick them out. Once in a while, as in McClellan's film of Richard III, they work rather magnificently. And for that matter, my favorite science fiction film of all time is not 2001 A Space Odyssey, or Alien, or Star Wars, or Blade Runner, or Ugh, The Matrix, but rather Forbidden Planet, better known to us cognoscenti as The Tempest on Altair 4, and starring Leslie Nielsen, Anne Francis, Walter Pidgeon, and Bat Gersten. But how could this be? How could critics and theatergoers and Shakespeareans possibly applaud these Bat Gersten productions, ripped untimely as they are from their natural and proper settings? The answer is simple. Motor cars or horses, tricorns or togas, ray guns or six-shooters, none of it matters, so long as the people remain. Sometimes we get so busy drawing boundaries and making labels that we lose track of that truth. Casablanca put it most succinctly. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. William Faulkner said much the same thing while accepting the Nobel Prize for Literature when he spoke of the old verities and truths of the heart, the universal truths lacking which any story is ephemeral and doomed, love and honor and pity and pride and compassion and sacrifice. The human heart in conflict with itself, Faulkner said, alone can make good writing, because only that is worth writing about. We can make up all the definitions of science fiction and fantasy and horror that we want. We can draw our boundaries and make our labels, but in the end, it's still the same old story, the one about the human heart in conflict with itself. The rest, my friends, is furniture. The house of fantasy is built of stone and wood and furnished in high medieval. Its people travel by horse and galley, fight with sword and spell and battle axe, communicate by palantir or raven, and break bread with elves and dragons. The house of science fiction is built of duralloy and plastic and furnished in faux future. Its people travel by starship and air car, fight with nukes and tailored germs, communicate by ansible and laser, and break protein bars with aliens. The House of Horror is built of bone and cobwebs and furnished in ghastly gothic. Its people travel only at night, fight with anything that will kill messily, communicate in screams and shrieks and gibbers, and sip blood with vampires and werewolves. The furniture rule, I call it. Forget the definitions. Furniture rules. Ask Phyllis Eisenstein, who has written a series of fine stories about a minstrel named Alaric, traveling through a medieval realm she never names. But if you corner her at a con, she may whisper the name of the kingdom. Germany. The only fantastic element in the Alaric stories is teleportation, a psi ability generally classed as a trope of SF. Ah, but Alaric carries a lute and sleeps in castles, and around him are lords with swords. So 99 readers out of every 100, and most publishers as well, see the series as fantasy. The furniture rules. Ask Walter John Williams. In Metropolitan and City on Fire, he gives us a secondary world as fully imagined as Tolkien's Middle-earth, a world powered entirely by magic, which Walter calls plasm. But because the world is a single huge decaying city, rife with corrupt politics and racial tensions, and the plasm is piped and metered by the plasm authority, and the sorcerers live in high-rises instead of castles, critics and reviewers and readers alike keep calling the books science fiction. The furniture rules. Peter Nichols writes, SF and fantasy, if genres at all, or impure genres. Their fruit may be SF, but the roots are fantasy, and the flowers and leaves perhaps something else again. If anything, Nichols does not go far enough, for westerns and mysteries and romances and historicals and all the rest are impure as well. What we really have, when we get right down to the nitty-gritty, are stories. Just stories. And that's what we have in the final section of this book. Some stories that I wrote. A little bit of this with a little bit of that. Weird stuff, folks. Just weird stuff. Under Siege, for instance. It's a time travel story. By definition, that makes it science fiction. Though come to think of it, isn't time travel actually a rather unscientific fantasy? Yet it began life as a mainstream historical. If you started reading this book at the beginning, as you should have, and didn't skip over my juvenilia, certain aspects of this story will seem oddly familiar to you. Yes, indeed. It's our old friend, The Fortress, which earned me an A in my first rejection, courtesy of Franklin D. Scott and Eric J. Fries. In 1968, The Fortress went into the drawer to hibernate. In 1984, I took it out again, added a dwarf and some time travel, called it Under Siege, and sold it to Ellen Datlow for Omni. Never throw anything away. Then there's The Skin Trade, the first and only story in my series about P.I. Randy Wade and Willie, the werewolf collection agent. I wrote that one for the 1988 installment of Dark Harvest annual horror anthology while I was out in L.A. working on Beauty and the Beast. I shared Night Visions 5 with Stephen King and Dan Simmons. To play on the same field as those two, I knew I needed to bring my game. Hunched over my computer at the old Seward offices of Beauty and the Beast long after everyone else had left, I would drink whole pots of coffee to keep myself awake and stagger home so wired that I couldn't sleep even when I tumbled into bed. It's a wonder that Willie Flambeau didn't come out talking like Vincent or vice versa. My deadline came and went, and on I wrote, months after King and Simmons had delivered. I have no doubt that Paul Michael of Dark Harvest was sorely tempted to give my place to someone faster. But when I finally got the story in, Paul wrote to say, "All right, it kills me, but it was worth the wait." In 1989, The Skin Trade won the World Fantasy Award for Best Novella, and I took home one of Gayon Wilson's wonderfully gloomy busts of H.P. Lovecraft to adorn my mantle. Sometimes I put a little hat on him. Unsound Variations is my chess story. It's got some time travel too, sure, but mostly it's my chess story. Not long after moving to Santa Fe, I had this swell idea for an anthology of science fiction and fantasy stories about chess. I could reprint Midnight by the Morphy Watch by Fritz Leiber, The Marvelous Brass Chess-Playing Automaton by Gene Wolfe, and Von Goom's Gambit, a wonderfully weird Lovecraftian short originally published in Chess Review. The rest of the book I would fill out with originals. I knew lots of writers who loved chess. Fred Saberhagen was one of them. Unfortunately, when I wrote him about my book, he wrote back to tell me he'd just sold the chess anthology to Ace and would be reprinting Midnight by the Morphy Watch and The Marvelous Brass Chess-Playing Automaton and Von Goom's Gambit. So, instead of him writing a story for my anthology, I wrote a story for his, Pawn to Infinity, drawing on my experiences as the captain of Northwestern's chess team. The story is fiction, to be sure, and any resemblance to actual persons living or dead is coincidental. But I would like to point out that I myself once actually fielded 6 teams for the Pan-American Intercollegiate Team Championships, a record that endured for close to 30 years. The Glass Flower has a sadder distinction. It marked the last time I ever returned to my old SF future history. Chloronymous was one of the touchstone names of that history, along with Stephen Cobalt Northstar, Erica Storm Jones, and Tomo and Wahlberg. I thought it was past time that I brought one of my mythic figures onto the stage. The Glass Flower appeared in Asimov's in September 1986. Except for Avalon, the abortive novel I began before getting caught up in A Game of Thrones and Doorways, I have not since visited any of my thousand worlds. Will I ever return to them? I make no promises. Maybe. That's the best I can do. Definitely, maybe. The Hedge Knight is a prequel to my epic fantasy series, A Song of Ice and Fire. set amongst the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros about 90 years prior to A Game of Thrones. Since the epic itself is far from finished, it would never have occurred to me to write a prequel had not Robert Silverberg phoned me to invite me to contribute to Legends, his gigantic new fantasy anthology. Big fantasy anthologies had been done before, of course, but Silverberg had put together an all-star roster of contributors for Legends, including Stephen King, Terry Pratchett, Ursula K. Le Guin, and most of the world's other leading fantasists. It was plain that the book was going to be huge, and I knew I had to be a part of it. I did not want to give anything away about the end of A Song of Ice and Fire or the fate of its principal characters, so a prequel seemed the way to go. Some of the other Legends contributors took the same route, as it turned out. The Hedge Knight is high fantasy. Nothing could be plainer. Or could it? Doesn't fantasy require, well, magic? I have dragons in the Hedge Knight, yes indeed, on helmet crests and banners, plus one stuffed with sawdust dancing on its strings. Oh, and Dunk remembers old Sir Arlen talking about seeing a real live dragon once. Perhaps that should suffice. If not, well, you can say the Hedge Knight is more a historical adventure than a true fantasy, except that all the history is imaginary. So what does that make it? Don't ask me. I just wrote it. I have since written a sequel, The Sworn Sword, for Robert Silverberg's Legends 2. More tales of Dunk and Egg will follow in the years to come, unless I'm run down by a bus or a better idea. The last story in the book is Portraits of His Children, a novelette for which I won the Nebula and lost to Hugo back in 1986. This is a story about writing and the price we writers pay when we mine our dreams and fears and memories. Back when Portraits was nominated for those awards, there was some spirited debate about whether or not it should actually be eligible. Is it a fantasy story or just a tale of madness? Is it neither? Is it both? You be the judge. So long as it's a good story, that's enough for me. Stories of the human heart in conflict with itself transcend time, place, and setting. So long as love and honor and pity and pride and compassion and sacrifice are present, it matters not a whit whether that tall, lean stranger has a proton pistol or a six-shooter in his hand. Or a sword. Armor-clinking Lord Durstan rode toward the crumbling old castle, hard by the waters of the dire lake, a drear land 1,000 leagues beyond the realms of men. He reined up as he drew near, and at that point a tall, lean elven lord stepped out from the mouth of a cave, a glowing longsword in one moon-pale hand. "Throw down your blade, Lord Durstan," the tall stranger lipped thinly. "You know it not, but you shall ride no more through the land of faerie." Fantasy? Science fiction? Horror? I say it's a story, and I say the hell with it.